This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, good to have you listen in today. Welcome to Trumpet Hour. I'm Joel Hilliker. After 16 years, Angela Merkel is winding down her chancellorship of Germany. And this week, she made her last visit to the state of Israel. Israelis honored her as a true friend of the Jewish state, and so she has been. But her views of Israel are actually at odds with most people in Germany, where anti-Semitism is rising. So what does Merkel leaving the scene mean for this relationship? We'll hear a report answering that question from our Jerusalem correspondent, trumpet writer Brent Nachtigall. A couple of troubling trends in America. First, the intensifying political divide that is turning this country really into two Americas. A new poll shows that about half of Americans believe our differences are so irreconcilable that it's time for some states to secede. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Rufato Manyepa about this. And second, the surge in violent crime. Recently released statistics show that last year saw a wave of murder and other crime. A report from trumpet writer Mihailo Zekic will look into some of the causes. Many governments are using COVID-19 as a pretext to expand their powers of surveillance and control over citizens. In Europe, there are indications that vaccine passports are only a stepping stone to a fully digital ID system for every EU citizen. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Daniel DeSanto about the implications of this development. And to finish the program, we'll talk about a powerful tool for navigating life's distractions and making better use of your time, and it can be boiled down to one simple word. We'll begin by looking at Chancellor Merkel's visit to Israel and what her retirement will mean for the Jewish state in this report from Brent Nachtigall.
When German Chancellor Angela Merkel soon leaves office, more than her German supporters will be disappointed. Israelis, too, will be saddened to see her go. For the past 16 years, Ms. Merkel has visited Israel more than any other world leader. Under her watch, Germany declared that it was part of Germany's reason for existence to protect the Jewish state. She initiated joint cabinet sessions between her government and that of Israel upon every visit to Jerusalem in an outward sign of closeness. But most crucially for Israel, Ms. Merkel always took responsibility for her countrymen's horrific slaughter of 6 million Jews during the Holocaust. This week, Merkel completed her 8th official visit to the State of Israel, meeting with Israeli leaders, holding a final joint cabinet session at the Knesset, and touring for her 6th time Yad Vashem, Jerusalem's Holocaust Museum. At the joint cabinet session on Sunday, Ms. Merkel again expressed Germany's responsibility for the Holocaust. She said, quote, "The story of the Shoah is, of course, a singular event for which we continue to bear responsibility in every phase of history, including the future. We are now in a transition phase where there will be soon no witnesses left, which is why we have to be aware that we will always keep this part of our sad and terrible history in the hearts and minds in order to simply draw the right lessons for the future. And Germany accepts this responsibility." End quote. This type of sincere sentiment, an acknowledgement of responsibility for the unparalleled attack on the Jews, as well as the need for vigilance that it never happens again, are hallmarks of her approach to the State of Israel. Such humility and understanding for Germany's wretched past are appreciated in Israel, and it's what Israel has come to expect from Ms. Merkel. This contrition toward Israel was best expressed by Ms. Merkel in March 2008, in a speech before the Israeli Knesset, where she became the first German chancellor to address the chamber. At the time, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flory called the address the most significant speech made by a German leader since World War II. Quote, "In speaking about the German atrocities committed against the Jews during the war, she made the statement that some people have been waiting to hear for over 60 years, end quote. This was the statement from Ms. Merkel. Quote, The mass murder of 6 million Jews carried out in the name of Germany has brought indescribable suffering to the Jewish people, Europe, and the entire world. The Shoah fills us Germans with shame. I bow my head before the victims. I bow before the survivors and before all of those who helped them so that they could survive." End quote. Such a statement from Germany's leader should have grabbed world headlines, Mr. Flory wrote at the time. Quote, "I personally have never heard such a repentant statement from a powerful leader in my life." End quote. And yet, the speech didn't garner that much traction outside of Israel. While Israelis generally admired and appreciated Merkel's speech, others wondered whether Merkel's contrition represented just her personal views or that of the German nation. The day following Merkel's Knesset speech, a Jerusalem Post column appeared titled, quote, "What Angela Merkel Couldn't Say Out Loud." Author Manfred Gerstenfeld wrote this, "Few in Israel realize that a majority of Germans probably disagree with several key statements she made here about her country's past, including the mention of shame and guilt." Unfortunately, Gerstenfeld's assertion that although it's appreciated that Ms. Merkel felt guilt and shame for her nation's past, the rest of Germany did not share her sorrow, has been proven time and again through Ms. Merkel's 16 years in office. Instead of following Ms. Merkel's courageous leadership at expressing shame for Germany's slaughter of the Jews, many Germans became increasingly ashamed of Ms. Merkel's repentance before the Jews. In 2008, it's likely that Merkel understood she was leading from the front to turn German hearts to repentance for the Holocaust. At the same Knesset speech, Merkel almost sounded like a prophet, declaring it was critical for Germans to internalize their culpability in the Holocaust. Quote, "Ladies and gentlemen, I most firmly believe that only if Germany accepts its enduring responsibility for the moral disaster in its history, we will be able to build a humane future." Put another way, unless Germans accept their responsibility in the Holocaust, another inhumane Germany will soon resurface. Merkel then got very specific in her speech in 2008. She said this, quote, "How, for example, do we react when the atrocities of the Nazis are played down? There can only be one response. Every attempt to trivialize these atrocities must be nipped in the bud. Anti-Semitism, racism, xenophobia never must be allowed to gain a foothold in Germany or Europe again, because otherwise all of us, German society as a whole, the European community, the democratic foundations of our countries, would all be placed in jeopardy." Again, she said, unless Germans repented for the Holocaust and unless anti-Semitism was stamped out in Europe, Merkel said in 2008, then history would indeed repeat itself. These were some very bold warnings from a courageous leader from a decade ago. Sadly, though, as Merkel completes her years in office, evidence is continuously emerging that Germany has failed to follow Merkel's lead. As Trumpet contributor Josue Michels noted last week, there is an alarming rise in anti-Semitism in Germany. Last year, Germany experienced the highest number of anti-Semitic crimes since record-keeping began in 2001, amounting to 2,275 separate acts, an average of 6 per day. The German government reported in August that 2020 experienced 580 anti-Semitic crimes in the East German states, a drastic increase in previous years. In April, the Berlin Research and Information Center on Anti-Semitism reported that Berlin experienced a 13% rise in anti-Semitic incidents in 2020 compared to 2019. In February, it was reported that the police had identified 1,367 anti-Semitic suspects from 2020, but only 5 had been arrested. And then, according to a 2020 CIVI survey, 33.5% of Germans believe their nation's handling of Nazi crimes is, quote, exaggerated. A full third of Germans currently believe the crimes of the Nazis were exaggerated. Michels then detailed several recent publicized stories of anti-Semitism in Germany. On September 30, an Israeli soccer team played at Berlin's Olympiastadion for the very first time. The game was meant to be a show of reconciliation. Instead, an Israeli flag was burned. A man was arrested for a Nazi salute, and Israeli fans received threats and insults. Then on October 4th, the German Jewish musician Gil Afarim was refused service at a luxury hotel in Leipzig until he took off his Star of David necklace. Then a few days later, Holocaust deniers vandalized 9 barracks at Auschwitz-Birkenau, spray-painting racial epithets and slogans against the Jews. This at one of the principal places where Germany attempted to enact the final solution. Witnessed together, these examples reveal a downward trend in Germany towards more anti-Semitism and less accountability for Nazi atrocities during World War II. They show that for all of Merkel's warnings, Germany has failed to follow her example. And as Merkel leaves office, it's very likely the next German leader won't cultivate the same culture of remembrance that Israel has enjoyed from this chancellor. That Merkel's courageous efforts were unable to counter Germany's spiraling anti-Semitism scourge was not unexpected. As Mr. Flory wrote following her 2008 speech, the Nazi spirit was already very much alive in Germany. Then he said this, quote, "I think that Angela Merkel's address in the Knesset was a moment of greatness for her, but her view will not prevail in Europe." How did Mr. Flory know that Germany would not follow the example of Chancellor Merkel? Recent history has shown that Germany's failed to fully take responsibility for the Holocaust, but it's Bible prophecy that reveals very clearly that German society will continue to give power to the spirit of anti-Semitism and will once again attempt to do the very thing that Miss Merkel warned against. Thankfully, the Bible also shows that this will be the very final resurrection of a European power that seeks to destroy Israel, after which the scourge of anti-Semitism will be finally routed forever from mankind. In order to understand these prophecies and to appreciate Miss Merkel's courageous decades-long warning against anti-Semitism, it's worth reading Gerald Flory's 2008 article, Angela Merkel's Historic Holocaust Speech.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
How divided is America right now? We'll get some troubling clues to the answer in this report from Rufaro Manyepa.
Nearly 80 million American voters favor secession from the Union, according to a recent poll from the Center of Politics at the University of Virginia. This poll shows that 52% of Donald Trump voters and 41% of Biden voters at least somewhat agree that it's time to split the country. America has rarely ever been more divided than it is now, and this division is even destroying democratic ideals. This poll went on to show that about 40 million voters from either side of the political aisle show a willingness to consider violating democratic tendencies and norms if needed to serve their priorities. They support the idea of a president acting free of congressional or judicial constraints, something that would only further deepen divisions. These are really alarming political ideals, and they're built on the dangerous foundation of pro-secessionism. Here's what the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics, Larry Sabato, said. "The divide between Trump and Biden voters is deep, wide, and dangerous. The scope is unprecedented, and it will not be easily fixed." That opinion that it won't be easily fixed is shared by many people who favor secession. Some, like Claremont Institute senior fellow David Reboy, want to call it a national divorce. Here's what he said, quote, "We have in America today what are essentially two competing, radically different, and mutually exclusive conceptions of the good, of justice, and of the proper role of the state in its interactions with its citizens. If we disagree on these big things, which will necessarily manifest in every political issue, large or small, what strong force could possibly reunite us? Or, to ask a question that's perhaps more pertinent, maybe not today or tomorrow but soon, what force could keep us from coming apart? End quote. Mr. Reboy makes several great points. Very few of America's founding ideals still unite people. If you look at the Judeo-Christian values on which the country was founded, so many of them are despised by those on the left. Marriage and family are considered obsolete and antiquated, possibly even harmful, by so many extremists. History is hotly disputed, largely because of the hateful movement that's driving the 1619 Project, for example. And the open border policy is leading to a disappearance of common culture and language. Even the United States Constitution, the supreme law of the land, is a topic of debate. But is secession the solution? History gives us an important lesson in that tolerating such thoughts is incredibly dangerous, yet a third of Americans are doing exactly that. If you go back to the Roman Empire in the 3rd century, Emperor Diocletian divided the empire into two halves, and that was the beginning of the end for the empire. Both these new halves, capitaled by Constantinople and Rome, were more open to invasion. Their constant squabbling between each other reduced the possibility of military collaboration, and it was simply a matter of time before half the empire was destroyed by external enemies. And that goes along with exactly what Jesus Christ himself said in Mark 3, verse 24 to 25. He said, "And if a kingdom be divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house be divided against itself, that house cannot stand." America's division is only deepening. And just as the Goths and the Vandals ultimately ravaged the Roman Empire, there are several enemies ready to take advantage of the division, weakening the United States from the inside. Here's what our Trumpet editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Fleury, wrote in the May-June 2020 print issue of The Trumpet. He said, "America's first civil war cost almost as many American lives as all other American wars combined. But another eruption of violence between Americans would be far worse. And if the country plunges into infighting, many foreign nations will be ready to pounce. America is the wealthiest nation in history. If it continues to destroy itself, nations like China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and others will destroy whatever the Civil War doesn't as they vie for the loot. The American superpower will become history, and a third world war involving multiple nuclear powers will follow. The Trumpet and before us, Herbert W. Armstrong, have warned of World War III for over 85 years. This was prophesied in your Bible. America's division is hastening the fulfillment of what God forecast thousands of years ago." End quote. Talk of amicable divorce is woefully misguided. Journalists and politicians are deliberately fomenting anger and hatred among the people. This tolerance and even yearning for division is more dangerous than many realize. And Americans won't even have the chance or desire to peacefully separate. The nation is headed for civil war. And this civil war is prophesied to come right before World War III. Jesus Christ prophesied of that in Matthew 24 and in Luke 21. But he also prophesied that there would be those who would escape the coming chaos. Here's what Mr. Fleury said. "God doesn't want people to suffer through the calamities that are coming. Those individuals who respond and heed God's warning, he will protect. And we must all see that these calamities are prophesied to occur in the very last days of America's existence as a strong world power, which is actually right before the Messiah comes to this earth to rule it." Now, these headlines in these stories might seem like more of the same old Republican versus Democrat politics. But these reports are real indications of just how close we are to prophecy being fulfilled. And please take action today. Request your free copy of Great Again by Mr. Gerald Flurry and read it alongside your Bible. Learn how God wants to protect you from the coming calamity and what you can do to come under His protection.
Thank you very much for that, Rufato. It is a remarkable state that we find ourselves in, where everything, it seems, everything is divisive in this country. It's really difficult to think of one thing that unites all Americans. And I think about just the country's response to coronavirus as a perfect example. We have this problem, you know, it's this virus that is plaguing us. And rather than the country pulling together to try to deal with this in the most responsible way, it has divided us all the more. And what makes it even more remarkable is it's essentially right along the same political lines that everything else is dividing us.
Yeah, I've been very surprised by just how much people are divided by this. I recently took a couple of trips to New York City and to Washington, D.C. And before getting there, I had this thought in my head that every single person that I interacted with or saw would be someone who had left-leaning ideals and such. But I was surprised by how many people within those, ostensibly blue areas had very conservative ideals, and how much people disagreed with what the state's direction was, how many people disagreed with the opinions on how to handle coronavirus, or in D.C. how they have the flags for the people who died from coronavirus. You know, one person said, "I wish they would show the flags of all the people who survived coronavirus instead. That would surely dwarf the number of the flags we see now." Like, even in those areas, people just can't find anything that unites them anymore. It's just all, every single topic, it's almost as though your opinion is formed by what side of the political aisle you're on, not necessarily what you believe anymore. It's just whether or not you identify as Democrat or Republican that informs what people believe in, and not necessarily what the truth is.
The quote that you gave us from David Riboy, where he basically says this is irreconcilable. It's impossible for these two sides to come together. We have such fundamental differences on basic founding ideas and ideals. It's a great point, and you know, more and more people can recognize it. But as you're saying, it's not as if all of the people who believe one way or the other way are concentrated completely geographically. The idea that if you just split the country into two sections, it's presuming that you basically have all the people who believe one way in one geographic area and all the people who believe in another in a different area. The truth of it is everybody is mixed and mingled and together, kind of like, you know, it's a big mosaic across the country. It's not like, you know, two or three sections. But the idea that we would somehow be able to amicably split into two countries is really naive.
Right. And you can actually get that from how they want to call it a divorce, a national divorce. And I think the idea he's trying to communicate is that, you know, the only thing that unites us possibly at this point is our mutual desire to split up, and that's enough for it to be peaceful. But, you know, you look at a regular divorce, and if you compare America to that, the fighting usually comes from, you know, which partner gets how much money, which partner gets these kids, how much time do they spend with them, and that's on a much larger scale, right, with America. You know, who gets these wealthy cities, who gets this particular tract of land that's arable for farming. And in that competition is where you're going to find that it's quite impossible for this nation to secede peacefully. It's a very naive idea to believe that it can just be a peaceful breakup and either side goes their way, because there's so much more at stake in this land with all of its resources, all of its wealth, all of its blessings, all of its infrastructure, than just separating and everyone going their own way.
Mm-hmm. You know, the results of this poll are really remarkable. How many Americans favor the idea of secession? And I recall it was in the July 2021 Trumpet edition. Gerald Flory wrote that article, What Will Happen After Trump Regains Power? And he focused on 2 Kings 14 and verse 28 that talks about Donald Trump warring to recover. And he made this one statement, I'll just read it to you. President Trump could also lead some states to secede from the Union. That would lead to some kind of warfare. I remember reading that and just thinking, wow, that is a phenomenal prophecy, or I guess not a prophecy, but he's stating this maybe as a matter of some speculation, that maybe there would actually be some kind of political split in America. It seemed like quite a stretch, but you look at how many Americans actually favor the idea, and
right.
You know that it would be messy, but you do have to wonder whether somehow, some way, people will actually try to make that reality.
It is a frightening proposition to think of, and just the number of people who are willing to fight for what they believe in and are willing to fight for their beliefs on both sides of the aisle. I think maybe they're a little bit more snowflakey on one side more than the other. But you think of people who rally behind Donald Trump and who see him as being the one force that remains preserving their ideals, the ideals on which their nation was founded. And if they want to keep that a reality, if they want to make sure that they don't lose what this country stands for, I think it's very easy to see how warfare could easily come about in such a circumstance.
Pretty remarkable. Well, we've been talking with trumpet writer Rufaro Manyepa about the division in America, irreconcilable division, and the increasing support for the idea, the radical idea, and probably nation-ending idea of secession. He's written an article about this called Poll, Half of Trump Voters in Favor of Secession. We appreciate you bringing that to our attention, Rufaro.
Always a pleasure, sir.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Violent crime in America is surging. We'll learn why in this report from Mihailo Zekic.
2020 was not kind to the United States. Over the year, violent crime increased dramatically nationwide. Citing material from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, United States Senator Tom Cotton, in an October 2nd article, called the situation one of the worst crime waves in American history. Nationwide, the murder rate rose by 29%, from 14,538 deaths in 2019 to 17,815 deaths in 2020. That's the biggest single-year increase the FBI has ever recorded. Deaths caused by drug overdoses, meanwhile, increased 30%. Gang-related deaths increased over 55%. In a September 27 press release, the FBI stated that, quote, for the first time in 4 years, the estimated number of violent crimes in the nation increased when compared with the previous year's statistics, unquote. The arson rate, meanwhile, increased to almost 35%. The property crime rate did go down, but the total cost for such crimes increased by almost $2 billion. The murder rate is also climbing on the local level. The murder rate of Los Angeles increased 38% from 2019 to 2020. In New York City, it increased 44%, with shooting incidents increasing 97%, almost double. And the murder rate in Chicago in 2021 has already overtaken 2020's record in July. Last year, Baltimore's murder rate was higher than that of El Salvador's or Guatemala's. To put that in perspective, Salvadorians and Guatemalans can claim asylum in the U.S. for fleeing from gang violence and murder, and yet parts of the country they're fleeing to have higher murder rate than where they're fleeing from. The city with the highest murder rate in the United States is St. Louis. Last year, it had a murder rate of 65.8 per 100,000 inhabitants. That's a higher rate than many cities worldwide with bad reputations for crime problems, like Cape Town, South Africa, Guatemala City, Guatemala, and Kingston, Jamaica. What is causing this crime surge? Last year's Black Lives Matter, or BLM, protests would have certainly contributed to this. The riots were the most expensive in U.S. history. The Minnesota state government estimated that the cost of the riots in the Minneapolis area alone is over $500 million. The kinds of drugs that people are consuming is also contributing to the drug overdose death toll. So-called typical hard drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine are bad enough. But 2020 saw a growth of the use of synthetic opioids like fentanyl. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid similar to morphine, but, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, is at least 50 times more potent. In 2015, synthetic opioids factored into only 18% of overdose deaths. That percentage is estimated to be over 60% in 2020. But one of the biggest causes for the crime spike would be the nationwide defunding of the police. Even though the FBI gathered data from over 100 additional law enforcement agencies than it did in 2019, it estimated 1,000 fewer police officers, Senator Cotton wrote in his article. He continued, "This isn't surprising. 86% of police chiefs report being short-staffed. Equally concerning, initial data shows that the number of police killed by criminals has increased 46% compared to this time last year." This May, the Trumpet asked in an article, "Would defunding the police prevent more crime?" "The numbers are in and the debate is over," Senator Cotton wrote. "The answer is no." Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote in his article, "Your Cities Are Burned with Fire," quote, "Many powerful politicians and people in the media believe that there is justification for the violence tearing up our cities. Many say that they understand why lawlessness is overtaking these areas. Some even think that there is something noble about it. They see it as a kind of righteous search for long-denied justice. This is terribly misguided and perverse reasoning. It is multiplying the problem many times over," unquote. Mr. Fleury wrote that in 2015, in the context of the death of Freddie Gray and the subsequent rioting in Baltimore. Fast forward 6 years, and the crime problem in America as a whole is multiple times worse over. We've seen racially charged rioters, especially in the aftermath of the death of George Floyd, caused the most expensive destruction America has ever seen. And their pressure campaigns to defund the police are causing the levels of so-called normal crimes to explode. Later in 2015, Mr. Fleury wrote another article called "Police Under Attack." In that article, he wrote, "America's law enforcement is under attack. On one side, people and communities are developing a mistrustful, hostile, antagonistic attitude, yelling at police, assaulting and even killing officers in some cases. Police are pulling back from doing their jobs for fear of attack or losing their jobs or going to prison for doing anything that could be perceived as racist. On the other, The federal government is undermining local law enforcement and stripping it of power in an effort to centralize policing power on the federal level. This isn't coincidence. There is a method to this madness, and it has little to do with racial justice. The rioters and authorities alike have an agenda, and it's not going to get any better. In the not too distant future, the forces behind the crime surges are going to grow out of control, and one way or another, they will impact the life of every American. To learn more, please read Your Cities Are Burned with Fire and The Police Under Attack at thetrumpet.com.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Many governments are using COVID-19 as a pretext to expand their control over citizens. One European company is speaking of plans for a digital ID being required of every EU citizen, as we will now hear in this report from Daniel DeSanto.
A precursor. That's what military technology company Thales Group called the vaccine passport in a blog post on July 27 on its website. Why a precursor? Because the vaccine passport is just the beginning of an entire digital identity system that Europe is developing and plans to make available for all citizens and businesses. Working with the European Commission, Thales Group, a French military technology company, is planning to develop the digital wallet within the next 10 years, although it could be deployed and tested as early as next year. The digital wallet is being promoted as a tool to make life easier for the average European citizen. But, in the wrong hands, this could easily become a powerful tool of increased surveillance and control. In Thales' blog post, entitled How Digital ID Can Help Citizens Access Government Services From Anywhere, the company stated, quote, "In June this year, the European Union took a step toward one of the largest digital identity projects ever when it proposed a framework for a Europe-wide digital identity. This would be available for all EU citizens, residents, and businesses in the EU." How exactly does the EU plan to reach this ambitious goal? The website continues, quote, "So-called digital vaccination passports will play a key role in enabling citizens to access all manner of services and will act as a precursor to the rollout of mobile digital ID. The idea behind the wallet is that all of the user's ID would be available through a smartphone-based application. They will be able to open bank accounts in foreign countries, access medical records and government services directly, apply for loans, and even sign real estate contracts. But that's not all. The EU wants to eventually integrate the digital euro as well. This would turn the project into a real digital wallet, allowing instant payments. In addition to this, the European Commission also plans to use the app to classify the trustworthiness level of different websites and businesses." Response to this announcement was mixed, although it was generally positive. However, some have warned about the dangers of trusting the European Union and national governments with so much personal data and control. Member of European Parliament Patrick Breyer of Germany stated, quote, "Entrusting our digital lives to the government instead of Facebook and Google is jumping out of the frying pan into the fire." He made this statement because much of the justification for such a system has come from the European Union's criticism of American big tech companies such as Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Twitter. When you examine the power that this would grant to the EU and national governments, it's not too much of a stretch of the imagination to understand how this tool could give the government gigantic control over vast swaths of society. For example, if a citizen has a bad credit rating, he could be categorized as such. If the central bank of his nation decided that certain purchases should be off limits to those with a credit rating below a certain threshold, he could be prevented from making certain purchases. Other financial penalties could also be imposed. The app could also allow governments to suppress online criticism. Criticize your national government, the EU, or an important social issue, and there's the potential that you could very easily and quickly be banned from social media and lose your access to certain government services. This would apply not only in your home country, but across all of Europe. Now, how likely is it that we'll see this in the near future? Well, much of the needed infrastructure is already present. As of 2019, smartphone use in Western European countries was at least 70%. At least 70% or more of people in these developed nations have smartphones and use them on a day-to-day basis. This is according to Pew Research Center. In some countries, it's a lot higher than 70%. A full 87% of Dutch reported owning a smartphone, along with 80% of Spanish, 78% of Germans, and 75% of French. Of course, changes to society may not be immediate, but if we do take the vaccine passport as the precursor that Thales called it, then we can say pretty reasonably that when this does come into effect, it will radically change Europe. Now, just how radically could developments like this change Europe, and should we expect that change in the near future? Here at The Trumpet, we rely on Bible prophecy to give us those answers, and regarding Europe, the Bible gives us quite a lot of detail. Revelation 17, verse 10 is one of those passages. It describes seven resurrections of the Holy Roman Empire, an empire which has resurfaced recurrently throughout European history. Now, every time this empire has risen and fallen, there has been a strong man, a strong leader, and each time this leader has had authoritarian, absolute power. Throughout history, this empire has risen and fallen six times. But the Bible prophesies in Revelation 17 that there will be a seventh and final resurrection of this deadly empire. The Bible also gives some interesting details on what kind of leader this empire will have in our time. In Daniel 8:23, the leader of this empire is described as, quote, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences, end quote. It may seem odd to discuss a king in the context of Europe right now, since the continent has been mostly democratic for over 70 years. But this prophecy describes a different, more authoritarian style of leadership soon to come. In our booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, explains that even if this man isn't literally called a king, he will rule in a kingly and authoritarian style. He notes that when the Bible talks about a king, in most cases, it's not referring to a democratic style of government. And he concludes that thought by saying that Europe is about to get a lot more authoritative. Developments like the digital wallet can certainly help us to see how that change could come about and what it could look like. And of course, all of this has been done in the name of coronavirus. Very early on in the coronavirus pandemic, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury talked about this on a Key of David program entitled Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire. He showed specifically how coronavirus is actually hastening the arrival of this dangerous empire. The vaccine passport and its successor, the digital wallet, are just one more among many examples of how accurate this prophecy is proving for Europe today. If you want to learn more about the style of rule that will soon come to a radically changed Europe, and how Europe's response to coronavirus is actually setting the stage for the arrival of this strongman, then read A Strong German Leader is Imminent, by Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury, and be sure to watch his Key of David program, Coronavirus and the Holy Roman Empire.
It's time for today's last word.
In today's world, we have a lot of things competing for our time and attention. We can be easily overloaded and overwhelmed with information, with emails and things to read and watch. Our to-do list is ridiculous. I want to give you one simple thing to help you navigate all of that, a powerful tool for making better use of your time. You're making your reading and studying more effective, just becoming more effective overall. And I'm talking about learning how to focus. Did you know that our brains cannot multitask? We literally cannot pay attention to more than one thing at a time. John Medina, a neuroscientist, in his book Brain Rules, 12 Principles for Surviving and Thriving at Work, Home, and School, wrote this: multitasking, when it comes to paying attention, is a myth. The brain naturally focuses on concepts sequentially, one at a time. To put it bluntly, research shows that we can't multitask. We are biologically incapable of processing attention-rich inputs simultaneously. And in this book, he shows how when we're doing something like listening to a lecture or working on a paper, the blood in our brain shifts to the anterior prefrontal cortex, which works like a switchboard operator. And when we do a particular task, it has to find the right neurons to do the job and switch them on. And this takes several tenths of a second. So whenever a different stimuli or task comes along, the brain has to disengage from that and then find the neurons for the other task and switch them on. All these steps have to take place every time we switch tasks. And he writes, it is time-consuming and it is sequential. That's why we can't multitask. That's why people find themselves losing track of previous progress and needing to start over, perhaps muttering things like, now where was I, each time they switch tasks. The best you can say is that people who appear to be good at multitasking actually have good working memories capable of paying attention to several inputs one at a time. Now, here's why this matters, Medina writes. Studies show that a person who is interrupted takes 50% longer to accomplish a task. Not only that, he or she makes up to 50% more errors. So the solution to this problem is our one word, focus. Now, what do I mean by focus? I'll give you 3 points. First, focus on a goal. You're not going to accomplish something if you don't put it at the top of your list. Let me read a quote from a book by Leo Babauta, The Power of Less, The Fine Art of Limiting Yourself to the Essential in Business and in Life. He writes, focus is the most important factor in determining whether you'll achieve a goal or stick to creating a new habit. Not self-discipline, not rewards, not sheer willpower, not even motivation, though this is also an important ingredient. If you maintain your focus on a goal or habit, you will more often than not achieve that goal or create that habit. If you can't maintain your focus, you won't achieve the goal unless it's such an easy goal that it would have happened anyway. It's that simple. So think about this. What are your priorities? Be sure that each day you do your most important thing first. We need to put God first each day in prayer and Bible study. At work each day, do your hardest work first, your most important task for the day. Don't let anything else get in the way. Don't do anything else until that is done. Focus on your goal in order to dictate your daily tasks and priorities. Second, focus on the task at hand. What are you doing at the present moment? Of course, you should ask whether it's really what you need to be doing, and if it's not, then do that. But put your full effort into whatever work you're doing. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10 says, "Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." Mr. Medina's recommendation is do one thing at a time. Forget multitasking. Focus on one task, single tasking. As it says in Proverbs 4 and verse 25, let your eyes look directly forward and your gaze be straight before you. Shut off distractions. Eliminate clutter in your workspace. Shut off email and the entire internet if possible. Turn off your cell phone. Focus on that one task. While you're working, if you feel the urge to check your email or switch to another task, stop yourself. Refocus. If something comes in while you're working, make a note of it and then get back to the task at hand immediately. Now and then, when you've completed the task, then you can process all those notes all at once. You can add tasks to your to-do list. You can refigure your schedule if you need to, process your email and all other inboxes at regular and predetermined intervals, not just whenever they happen to pop up. Stay focused on the task at hand. And third, focus on completion. Don't get so wrapped up in planning, laying out your tasks and your timeline, getting it all situated in your calendar program and all that, so that becomes a distraction. The real focus of any project should be in getting it done, completion. Each day, make sure you're moving it forward to completion. Make sure the tasks you're doing are really worth doing, that they're advancing your goals. This is what Babauta wrote. Anytime you find yourself procrastinating on an important task, see if you can break it into something smaller. Then just get started. Don't procrastinate, just get started. Once you've gotten started, you will gain momentum and will have broken through the initial resistance barrier, and you'll be much more likely to continue to the next small task and the next one until the large task is completed. Small tasks are always better than large ones. The May 1985 Good News said this: proper management of time depends on proper management of yourself. What we're talking about really is a character issue. Building your focus is a powerful tool, not just for being more productive, but for building your character. So focus on your goal. Focus on the task at hand. Focus on completion. And whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Brent Noctegal, Rufaro Manyepa, Mihailo Zekic, and Daniel DeSanto. Thanks to Nick Irwin and Dwight Falk for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. It is better to deserve honors and not have them than to have them and not deserve them. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.